This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So let me bring this down a little. I am indeed Leonard Wallach. I'm the founder and the current program coordinator for the Herman P. and Sophia Taubman Foundation Endowed Symposia in Jewish Studies at UCSB, otherwise known simply as the Taubman Symposia. Since its establishment 16 years ago, the symposia has brought writers, journalists, political leaders, artists, filmmakers of great distinction from all over the Middle East, Europe, back east, Canada, here to our community and also to our campus. We hold about 8 or 9 events each year, and one of the best things about them is that they are free and open to the public. I say that with a great sense of appreciation, not only to the Taubman Foundation, which endowed the series, but also to local institutions from the Jewish community, both those of which we're all members, and also to private donors who help sustain our work each year. So thank you very much for your generosity. Those upon whom we depend are very, very appreciatively listed in the program that was distributed to you tonight as you came in the hall. This year, we've presented an award-winning novelist, Maggie Anton, former U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Martin Indyk, the Chief Rabbi of the United Kingdom, Jonathan Sacks, and the critically acclaimed documentary, Orchestra of Exiles, which you haven't seen, I really, really recommend. And although you may think of the Taubman Symposia as a local institution, in fact, it reaches an enormous audience worldwide. For example, the superb presentation that Martin Indyk made last fall at UCSB has now been downloaded on websites 60,000 times. People have seen it all over the world. And it's the kind of presentation that over the next year or two will be seen probably 300,000 times. So yes, we are local, but we are also global. However large its footprint, the Taubman Symposia is actually a very small entity. Essentially, I run it with the help of a program committee that's headed by Professor Richard Hecht in the Department of Religious Studies at UCSB, and also a few dedicated undergraduate students who are really the best thing in town. And they can do the work of many, many more than just three. This being the end of the academic year, when those of us who've helped mentor such students feel a great sense of anguish upon their graduation, I do want to acknowledge three very special people. First, Sapir Ohayon is the campus coordinator for the Taubman Symposia at UCSB. Please stand. She's back there in a hurry. Next, Brittany Susnow, who is a student assistant in the Walter H. Capps Center and also works with the Taubman Symposia. And while it is true that they are leaving, the good news is, in Sapir's case, she's being replaced by a very gifted young undergraduate, Jake Spire, who is now in his second year at UCSB and who will become the campus coordinator for the Taubman Symposia this coming year, Jake Spire. Being that we're very modest in size, of course, we do regularly partner with the Jewish institutions of this community, who are very generous in allowing us the use of their halls, allowing us the facilities that we need to do such things as the videotaping, not to mention sharing with us the audiences that can congregate in the various nonprofits here. So to all of them, and particularly tonight, to Congregation B'nai B'rith, we want to express our deep gratitude. When I heard from Ken Rotman, who runs the Sunday morning live program here at Congregation B'nai B'rith, his idea that we marry a dinner on the one side to a speaker on the other, can you imagine what I said? sounds like a great idea. And particularly because, as you've heard, it was done with great generosity on the part of those who cook and also on the part of the Harters, for whom we're deeply indebted. And in keeping with the occasion, I, of course, decided that a good, you know, guest brings a dessert. And so I decided to do some research with the help of Jake and decided that, well, maybe the best place to go for a good Jewish dessert in L.A. would be Bee's Bakery in Tarzana. The other thing I should add by way of thanks, and that will end it, is that Karen Wilson is probably the only guest speaker who I have ever asked to bring her own dessert. She indeed did pick it up and drive it this afternoon. So tonight it's a great pleasure to introduce Karen, who will be giving us a personal guided tour of the major exhibition, which is entitled Jews in the Los Angeles Mosaic, which she just finished curating for the Autry National Center in Griffith Park. She is the Sadie and Ludwig Kahn Research Fellow at the UCLA Center for Jewish Studies. She's also the head curator of the Mapping Los Angeles, Jewish Los Angeles Project. And in addition, she is now a lecturer in the UCLA Department of History. Her groundbreaking exhibition, which opened to glowing reviews earlier in the month, is scheduled to run until January 5th, 2014. So you've got some time. After touring the exhibition, a writer for the Los Angeles Daily News admired the way in which, quote, it peers through the different lenses of community, society, and family histories as it examines the key moments, eventful turns, and characteristic stories that illuminate the interweaving of Jews and Los Angeles from as far back as the Gold Rush. As a companion piece to the exhibition, Karen has also edited and contributed to a fascinating collection of essays, which is titled Jews in the Los Angeles Mosaic, and which has just been published by the University of California Press. I urge you to make haste, get the volume, and give it to a Jewish Angelino. It's my pleasure to introduce Karen Wilson.
So thank you very much, Leonard, and thank you all for inviting me here. It's really a privilege and an honor to be part of this symposia. And just on a personal note, Maggie Anton is actually a friend of mine, so I like that we're bookending your year of symposia. And I also want to thank the Lodge guys and Congregation B'nai B'rith for hosting us all here tonight. This is my first opportunity to visit this synagogue, and the drive up was great, and it's a beautiful place, so I'm very happy to have that experience. I'm pretty sure, I've met some of you now, chatted with you, but I'm pretty sure that some of what I will say tonight will seem familiar, not necessarily in the specifics, but in the generalities. Some are going to be more, it's going to be familiar to more of you, I realize, than I had originally thought, because there's quite a number of you from Los Angeles here. But Jews have been living in Santa Barbara almost as long as they have in Los Angeles. And in both places, Jews have added to and engaged with the diversity that has been characteristic of California even before European explorers made contact with Native Americans. So as I attempt to explain and illustrate how Los Angeles has shaped Jewish identities and how Jewish Angelenos have shaped the metropolis, I invite you to reflect on the parallels of the two places, and afterwards, perhaps you can share with me the divergences, the differences. As you probably know, Los Angeles has the second largest Jewish population in North America, and arguably the most varied in the world, with representatives from Israel and virtually every diasporic community asserting Jewish identities that range from religious to ethnic to political to social. The roots of the Jewish community in LA took hold when California became part of the United States in the mid-19th century. In exploring a history that stretches over 160 years, minuscule, I understand, in Jewish history. But nevertheless, pretty long period of time in California, there are many possible paths of inquiry and many possible answers to how Jewish Angelenos have influenced LA and how they have been influenced by the region. More answers than could possibly fit in my time allotted tonight, and more than we could possibly fit in one exhibition. So when you go see Jews in Los Angeles in the Los Angeles Mosaic at the Autry National Center, which I know you all will go see it, understand that it highlights representative historical tracks and trails of that mutually influential relationship, just as I will do tonight. So I am going to give you a preview of the exhibition, in that all of the illustrations I'm using tonight do come from the exhibition. But you're actually going to get a little more of the inside story, more of my personal take on things. So you can carry it around with you when you go see the exhibition, your own private tour. So the history of Jews in Los Angeles is both familiar and unique. It's familiar as the story of the growth of an American metropolis and the aspirations of its citizens. It's unique as Jews have been both at the center and the margins of the economic, social, political, and cultural events that have shaped contemporary Los Angeles. For Los Angeles, Jews have been a persistent, urbanizing, diversifying influence. Both impulses have actually been resisted in Los Angeles, and Jews have led the way in countering that resistance. For Jews, Los Angeles has been a place of testing and often realizing individual, communal, and social possibilities. Together, the place and its Jewish residents have made each other harbingers of the American future. The center-defying urban suburbia of Los Angeles marks the development patterns of more and more American cities. More and more American places are looking like Los Angeles. The experimentation, innovation, and optimism of LA Jewry increasingly extends into the consciousness of national and international media, communal organizations, and advocacy groups. That expanding effect of place and people stands on both the fluidity of society in the American West and the persistent adaptability of modern Jews. One important note here, Jews, and this should not be a shock to anyone in this room, Jews have never been a significant proportion of the population of Los Angeles County. In the 19th century, they constituted less than 2.5% of the residents. Today, they are about 6.5%, probably the largest proportion it has ever been. For comparison, Jews in the New York metropolitan area today make up about 14 to 16% of the population. So these figures, these small percentages, make the role of Jews in Los Angeles history all the more remarkable and help explain the persistent energy of LA Jewry. In LA and most other American cities today, all Jews are Jews by choice. There is no taking for granted a Jewish identity. It has to be cultivated, nurtured, and asserted. And so this story that I'm about to, this journey I'm about to take you on, is really about that cultivation, nurturing, and assertion of a Jewish identity. The association of Los Angeles and Jews is not a commonplace one. If people do make an association, it generally revolves around one of what I call LA's most famous Jewish neighborhoods, Hollywood, or Boyle Heights. The connection between the Jewish moguls and the invention of Hollywood, that is, the motion picture industry, is well studied and well known to people around the world. And these are the logos of 6 of the 8 major studios that were headed by Jewish executives in the 20s and 30s and 40s. excuse me. Locally, those Angelenos who have grown up or lived a long time in the metropolis and perhaps moved to Santa Barbara often know Boyle Heights as a predominantly Jewish neighborhood in the decades just before World War II. In fact, many Jewish Angelenos believe that is where and when the history of Jews in LA began, because that's where their parents or grandparents first settled. But as I have alluded to, the history goes back farther, and as you will see, the Jewish presence has encompassed the breadth of LA County. The Jewish presence in Los Angeles was documented in the first U.S. census taken in California. 8 Jewish bachelors, all European immigrants and merchants living in the back rooms of their stores in a single commercial block, appeared in the 1850 tally, which counted about 1,600 people in the LA city proper and about 3,500 people in the whole county, which extended all the way down to San Diego County at that time. The discovery of gold brought an international rush of people to California, including significant numbers of European and American Jews. Between 1848, when the find at Sutter's Mill drew the world's attention to the newly acquired U.S. territory, to 1850, when California became the 31st American state, over 100,000 people had settled within its borders. Although rumors of gold nuggets lying about waiting to be picked up brought people here, the reality of hard work and harsh working conditions greeted them. Those with the aptitude and ability quickly shifted occupations. After mining, commerce was the most important economic engine for California. From the first days of the gold rush, Jews and other migrants had found selling clothing, tools, boots, groceries, and liquor to be a lucrative and less dangerous way to cash in on the riches of El Dorado. Away from the immediate chaos of the gold rush, Los Angeles became home to a small number of Jewish merchants, including the original 8, content to supply foodstuffs, clothing, and hardware to the miners who were coming from Mexico and Central and South America, passing through Los Angeles on the way to Northern California, to supply those items to the local ranchero families who grew rich selling beef to the hungry hordes up north, and the slowly increasing number of townspeople who settled around the colonial era plaza, the new American town of El Monte, and the port town of San Pedro. They formed the nucleus of an entrepreneurial class that transformed and diversified the cow-dependent economy of Southern California. Typical of frontier settlement, early Jewish settlers in Los Angeles were young, single men, some in their teens, most in their 20s and 30s. A number relocated to LA from San Francisco and Sacramento, others from St. Louis and New Orleans, while some came directly from Europe, England, France, Hungary, Russian Poland, various German states. Most followed brothers, cousins, and other relatives west. 19-year-old Harris Newmark, for example, arrived from Prussia in 1853 to work for his brother as a clerk in a small storefront a few blocks south of the LA Plaza. Newmark eventually established what became the largest wholesale grocery firm in Southern California, owned the largest and oldest business block in the city, expanded into the cultivation of oranges and real estate development, and wrote a memoir entitled 60 Years in Southern California that remains one of the central histories of 19th century Los Angeles. 16-year-old Isaias Hellman came from Bavaria in 1859, clerked for his cousin for 6 years, then started his own store, and became one of LA's first bankers and its first successful banker by the age of 28. Because of his financial acumen and sound ethics, Hellman was recruited to San Francisco to reorganize what eventually became the Wells Fargo Bank under his leadership. You may be familiar with a recent biography of Hellman entitled Towers of Gold, How One Jewish Immigrant Named Isaias Hellman Created California, by Frances Dinkelspiel, his great-great-granddaughter. The subtitle is no exaggeration, as Hellman, through his endeavors in L.A. and San Francisco, was a force in most of the major economic arenas that produced the California we live in. He was a leader in finance, transportation, oil, electricity, land development, water, wine cultivation, and education. He served as a regent for 25 years on the UC Board of Regents. He wouldn't touch the motion picture industry. Too risky in its early days, but then he died in 1920 before it became the largest industry in the state and the fourth in the world. I think if he had lived a little longer, he would have jumped on that too. A final example of the role of Jewish pioneers' influence of the economic diversity of the region is the story of Bernath Rosin, a Jewish Hungarian who helped make Catalina Island a popular tourist destination. He owned a saloon, a bowling alley, and one of the first hotels on the island. And he even lent his daughter, Ethel, for this early postcard promotion, a pre-Photoshop magical transformation that put the three-year-old on a tuna wave rider. So they took a picture of her on the sand, and then they filled in the ocean. I don't know how they did it, but it's very clever. As their businesses grew, the young Jewish men married and started families. The arrival of the aunt and uncle of Harris Newmark in 1854 marked an important milestone for the society to come. First, they brought with them four daughters, shown in this photograph, helping to increase the pool of potential Jewish wives, a very important ingredient to a future Jewish community. They all married successful LA merchants, all celebrated their 50th wedding anniversaries, and they bore a large number of children, thus ensuring another generation of Jewish Angelenos. I sometimes joke that without the Newmark daughters, there really wouldn't be a Jewish community in LA. Second, Rosa and Joseph Newmark became pillars, that's the aunt and uncle, the older people in this photograph. Rosa and Joseph Newmark became pillars of the Jewish and general communities, modeling and reinforcing a distinctively Jewish commitment to the collective that stood in contrast to the freewheeling individualism that characterized the frontier. From the founding of the Hebrew Benevolent Society, the first charitable organization in the county that lives on as Jewish Family Service of LA today, to the formation of Congregation B'nai B'rith, the one in LA, and the erection of the city's third house of worship following the Mexican-era Catholic Church on the plaza and the Methodist Church, the Newmarks, their children, and extended family made Jewish customs, values, and rituals part of the ethos of the transforming town. Jews who lived in 19th century Los Angeles experienced the rare opportunity, for Jews anyway, to be part of remaking a small town into a growing city, transforming a county of cowherds into a center of unprecedented agricultural production, tourism, and new industries. In on the ground floor, so to speak, Jews envisioned and achieved economic mobility, communal stability, and social integration more readily and fully accessible to them here than in Europe or elsewhere in the United States. They did so by confidently developing cross-cultural relationships as they adapted to an evolving pluralistic society. With fortuitous timing and persistence, working to make the possible real and engaging with the diversity of the place and the population, they became Angelenos. They learned English and Spanish, both official languages of the county, until the 1870s. Morris Kramer, a French Jew and a Newmark son-in-law, apparently even learned Chinese, enough so he made a very effective county tax collector, able to collect from those Chinese merchants in town. Jewish Angelenos joined the Masonic Lodge, the Odd Fellows, and the Ladies Benevolent Society. They ran for and won political office, headed up fundraising drives to support the orphanage run by the Catholic Sisters of Charity. They formed business partnerships with American Protestants and Irish Catholics and hosted other middle and upper class Angelenos, non-Jews, in their homes and synagogue. Because they did not isolate or insulate themselves from the larger society, instead working actively with non-Jews to build community, Jewish Angelenos achieved the mobility and integration and ethno-religious continuity and security they sought. They offered and solicited support for creating and sustaining ethnic and religious institutions, their own as well as those of others, including they solicited funds to build the two synagogue buildings they built in the 19th century. This is a photograph of a capital column from the second building. So they raised money from non-Jews to build that, and they contributed to building Methodist Church, St. Vimbriana's Cathedral, and other religious buildings as well. They, by connecting and collaborating, Jewish Angelenos negotiated the unfamiliarity, volatility, and heterogeneity of life on a cosmopolitan, diverse frontier, thus securing a continuous presence in the Los Angeles mosaic. Diverse networks facilitated this Jewish integration into this modern pluralistic society, supported, as I mentioned, the development of Jewish communal institutions, and shaped individual Jewish mobility. Jewish Angelenos in the 19th century helped produce American Los Angeles, defined by mutual strangers turned friends, by diversified economic opportunities, and by customs of cross-cultural collaboration and support. When the complexion of Los Angeles began to change, the foundation created by the pioneer Jewish Angelenos allowed for continuity and growth of the Jewish community. In the first half of the 20th century, the relationship between Los Angeles and its Jews grew more complicated, buffeted by rapid population growth, industrialization, and sharpening social divides. As white Protestants gained a numerical majority, the place of minority groups diminished literally and figuratively. Restrictive covenants in property deeds created white-only neighborhoods, while private clubs, social political parties, and corporations used race, religion, and gender bias to keep minorities and women out of their ranks. Religion and their ambiguous status as white often put Jews in neighborhoods with Mexican Americans, African Americans, and Japanese Americans. Wealth and occupation, on the other hand, allowed some Jews to continue to engage with the white establishment in business, cultural, and civic matters. As Los Angeles grew more fragmented, distinctions among the Jewish population became more pronounced. The rise of Hollywood created a new class of Jewish elites whose conservative politics and vision of America clashed with the liberal perspectives of a recently arrived Jewish working and lower middle class, notably concentrated in Boyle Heights. Despite their differences, though, these Jewish communities rose simultaneously to contest efforts to make Los Angeles a center of Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture, its racial, ethnic, and religious diversity marginalized. As Los Angeles became the nation's fastest growing metropolis, the Jewish population grew as well, with immigrants long in the U.S. and their American-born children making up the bulk of Jewish newcomers. In addition to its pleasant climate, with its healthy air, and it was healthy then, and perpetual sunshine, Los Angeles offered space for single-family homes and jobs in real estate, construction, retail, and the fledgling motion picture industry. A large contingent of Jews with Eastern European roots and a smaller wave of Sephardic Jews, mainly from Rhodes, provoked a multitude of new and expanded community institutions addressing needs ranging from healthcare to religious education to making new friends. The 19th century Jewish community was supported by five institutions. After 1900, that number exploded tremendously. During these early decades of the 20th century, the attractions of clean air and a mild climate drew large numbers of people with health problems, including Jews with what was known then as consumption, or tuberculosis. In response, the Jewish community established the Jewish Orphans Home for the children left behind when fresh air and sunshine provided no cure. Also, the Jewish community established the Kasper Cohn Hospital, later named Cedars of Lebanon, the Mount Sinai Home for the Incurables, later Mount Sinai Hospital, and the Jewish Consumptive Relief Association. I've been told that there was a Yiddish saying around this time that the only reason you went to Los Angeles is if you had one lung or two wives. And the number of at least people with one lung bear out that saying. But beginning in 1913, with two tents on 10 acres in Duarte, northeast of downtown Los Angeles, the Jewish Consumptive Relief Association garnered tremendous local support for its vision of a city of hope. The Los Angeles Sanatorium, where consumptives were given medical treatment such as it existed, there was no real treatment at the time, rest, healthy food, and access to fresh air and sunshine at no cost. And by the way, this service was provided to Jews and non-Jews alike, which is also one of the characteristics of virtually all the Jewish organizations that I've studied in Los Angeles. It became the first local Jewish organization in Los Angeles to raise funds nationally, enlisting workmen circle chapters and labor unions, and establishing auxiliary groups in cities across the U.S. to help build patient cottages and medical buildings in the desert. And this is a photograph of one of the patient cottages. You notice the people sitting on the porch. So the idea was just to let them rest and breathe in fresh air to extend their life as long as possible. The great weather and terrific scenery also drew the pioneers of movie making to Los Angeles. Jews made Hollywood, and Hollywood made Los Angeles. By 1920, motion picture production was the biggest industry in the county. By 1926, movie making was the largest industry in California and the fourth largest worldwide. During the 1920s, 90% of all movies made in the world were created in Los Angeles. To meet the demand that they had helped create as Nickelodeon and theater owners and film distributors, native and immigrant Jews came to LA to escape the narrow vision of those back east who thought movies a mere novelty. They came to make story pictures with movie stars to show in their theaters and to realize the full potential of the popular new medium. Men such as Jesse Lasky, who was born in San Francisco, Carl Laemmle from Germany, the Warner Brothers, sons of a Polish cobbler, and Louis B. Mayer, Russian-born, lived and sold their versions of the American dream as heads of the most successful movie studios. First-time director Cecil B. DeMille, who, by the way, had a Jewish mother and Episcopalian father, representing the Lasky Feature Play Company, leased the barn of a Jewish real estate developer named Jacob Stern at the corner of Selma and Vine Streets in Hollywood to use as a studio for the filming of The Squaw Man. And this is a photograph of that makeshift studio. Feature Play Company executive Jesse Lasky extended the lease for the barn with Stern Realty, securing a site for continued production in Hollywood. They were here to stay. While motion picture companies from New York and New Jersey had started shooting short films in and around L.A. as early as 1906, and several studios of varying size existed in the region by 1912, the decision of Jesse Lasky Feature Play Company in 1913 to lease and later purchase Stern's property while filming the first feature-length film shot entirely in Los Angeles really marks the beginning of Hollywood as the center of movie making. Now, the motion picture industry created jobs and new kinds of business opportunities for Angelenos. One stellar instance of that influence is the case of Polish immigrant Max Factor, who capitalized on the nearby presence of the industry to popularize the use of cosmetics. Going from wig maker to the Russian Tsar's theatrical troupe, to glamour guru to the stars in Los Angeles, Factor pioneered makeup suitable for the hot, bright lights of motion pictures, and used the allure of movie stars to legitimize its use beyond stage and screen. The 1935 grand opening of the renovated Max Factor studio and factory on Highland Avenue at Hollywood Boulevard attracted over 10,000 people, about three times the number who had received personal invitations. The opening was the first occasion in Hollywood when searchlights were used to mark an event other than a movie premiere, drawing stars and fans on par with the debut of a major motion picture. Inside the elegant makeup studio, which had special rooms depending on hair color, so there was the brunette room, the blonde room, the redhead room, all about 900 special guests autographed this giant scroll. It's not a real animal skin. We don't actually know what the material is, but this giant scroll was set up, and people autographed it. And it hung near the entrance of the building for many decades afterwards. And among the autographs that you'll see when you go to the exhibit are Judy Garland, Bela Lugosi, one of the Three Stooges, a lot of other really famous people from that particular era. The power and influence of the motion picture industry spread rapidly beyond Los Angeles. In 1930, 80 million people, 65% of all U.S. residents, went to movie theaters every week. From 1937 to 1946, Louis B. Mayer, head of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, was the highest paid executive in the nation, earning $1.3 million annually. And that's in, 1937 dollars, okay? I can't even do the calculation for what it would be today. Such pinnacles of success required movie producers to focus on the entertainment value of the movies, balancing the expectations of the bankers who financed them, the moral reformers and evangelists who painted them as evil influences, and the unpredictable public that determined their fortunes every week. For nearly two decades, the conservative moguls generally kept social and political issues out of their movies. In some cases, that they've been criticized for that, to keep the box office receipts flowing. Then there arose a threat to those riches and a call by conservatives outside the industry to unleash the power of the movies to shape an election. In response, Hollywood invented media politics in 1935 when Irving Thalberg and Louis B. Mayer used the power of the movies against popular muckraking author and socialist Upton Sinclair in his campaign for governor of California. In a series of fake newsreels, Sinclair was portrayed as radical and un-American with a plan to draw vast waves of unemployed people to the state at the height of the Depression. The studio heads and other Republicans saw Sinclair as too sympathetic to organized labor and too inclined towards strong regulation and high taxation of business. Now, some complaints never change, right? Although the newsreels were recognized as propaganda at the time and denounced by Sinclair and his supporters, they proved effective as the candidate supported by the moguls, Frank Merriman, won the election. With Adolf Hitler's rise to power in Germany in 1933, Hollywood became both a target for American fascist groups and a refuge for Jewish Europeans fleeing Nazi anti-Semitism. Through movies, radio programs, public events, and organizations such as the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League, studio heads, producers, directors, writers, and actors worked to educate the American public about the racist, violent agenda pursued by fascists at home and abroad. Beginning with the exclusion of Jews from German educational and cultural institutions and the German film industry, Los Angeles drew some of Europe's most celebrated composers, artists, and writers in large measure because the movie studios offered jobs and supportive networks. In some of the studios, the employees self-taxed to raise money to help these refugees. Local fascist groups and Nazi sympathizers tried to stir up anti-Semitic outrage with marches, meetings, and calls for boycotts of movies. Copies of this flyer reportedly were thrown from the top of the Taft Building on Hollywood Boulevard in 1938, attracting attention as they created a paper snowstorm on the pedestrians below. An anti-Semitic flyer slipped into copies of the Los Angeles Times during the same period, provoked a denouncement of the sentiments from the breadth of Los Angeles civic and religious leadership, including Harry Chandler, the publisher of the Times, well known for his dislike of Jews. But overt anti-Semitism, especially by people that were considered outsiders, was just not to be tolerated. Located east of downtown, our other Jewish neighborhood, famous Jewish neighborhood, located east of downtown Los Angeles, across the city's namesake river, Boyle Heights first appeared on LA maps as a subdivision created in 1875 by William H. Workman, Jewish banker Isaias Hellman, whom I mentioned before, and John Lazarevich. In the 1880s, it became a streetcar suburb housing white-collar workers. In the early decades of the 20th century, further subdivision encouraged a stable, diverse neighborhood of skilled and semi-skilled workers, young professionals, and small business owners, many of whom who owned their own homes. Native and foreign-born Mexicans, Jews, and Japanese residents lived alongside African-Americans and Russian Malekans. Union activism, radical politics, and cross-cultural alliances made Boyle Heights the center of the marginalized in LA. As large and small battles for the promise of Los Angeles increasingly broke out along lines of white versus not white, native versus foreign, the melting pot of Boyle Heights became a testing ground for multicultural collaboration and concord. The Homeowners Loan Corporation, or the HOLC, was a New Deal, a Depression-era program established in 1933 to help families prevent the loss of their homes through mortgage foreclosure with federally guaranteed loans. HOLC devised a standardized system of appraisal in order to evaluate the potential loan risks associated with urban properties. The neighborhood appraisals generally reflected, among other factors, prevailing social prejudices against people of color, foreigners, Jews, and Catholics. As a result, neighborhoods with significant racial or religious heterogeneity or large concentrations of non-white groups were given a loan security grade that usually precluded HOLC-backed mortgage loans. Security grades were indicated by specific colors on maps of urban areas created from the appraisals. Green for the most positive grade, which you'll notice are kind of at the beach and on the outskirts of this map, and red for the most negative, with blue and yellow for grades in between. Labeled D53 in the 1939 survey of Los Angeles, Boyle Heights was entirely red. And Boyle Heights, you see those two large red areas to your right. That one of those is Boyle Heights and the other is City Terrace. So Boyle Heights was described as hopelessly heterogeneous by the Homeowners Loan Corporation. But it became the launching ground for returning Los Angeles electoral politics to its 19th century diversity. Jews helped elect Edward Roybal to the LA City Council in 1949, the first Latino on the council in over 50 years. From the growing Jewish neighborhoods on the west side of LA, Roslyn Weiner, later Wyman, joined Roybal in 1953, becoming the first Jew on the council since the 1890s. The influence of the Boyle Heights ethos eventually led to the election of the first African-American mayor of a major U.S. city in 1973, Tom Bradley. And this was a development that defied conventional wisdom that held that racially mixed coalitions couldn't win elections. Black and Jewish Angelenos made it happen in L.A. In the post-World War II baby boom, an unprecedented spike in the American birth rate that set off an explosion of suburbia, the possibilities for mobility available to Jewish Angelenos exponentially expanded along with the prosperity of the region. Jews became both developers and residents of suburbs, creators and patrons of elite and popular cultural institutions, and instigators and agitators for social change. All of these roles had local repercussions, national influence, and international significance. Amidst sprawl and upheavals, the varieties of Jews and Judaism multiplied as Los Angeles became home to the fourth largest Jewish population in the world, and as one rabbi has impressed upon me, the most diverse ever in Jewish history. Aspirations for the good life, unleashed after over a decade of depression and war, made Los Angeles the nation's leader in suburban development. Taking their urban sensibilities with them, middle-class Jews joined their fellow Angelenos in moving to Lakewood, Encino, Westchester, and other new regional cities on the edge of the metropolis. Lakewood was the West Coast's answer to Levittown, New York, the mass-produced planned community that became the model for American suburbs in the 1950s and 1960s. But the Jewish developers of Lakewood, Mark Taper, Louis Boyer, and Ben Weingart, set new records in size and quickness as the 17,500 home community on 3,500 acres just north of Long Beach went up in 33 months. By 1954, on land that had passed through the hands of Spanish foot soldier Manuel Nieto and Yankee pioneer John W. Bixby and his partner, Jewish banker Isaias Hellman, among others, nearly 100,000 residents were living in tomorrow's city today on the suburban frontier. At the same time new kinds of suburbs were springing up, LA became recognized as home to some of the most innovative realizations of modernist urban architecture, due in large part to the presence and work of Jewish architects Rudolf Schindler and Richard Neutra. And the successive generations of architects from Gregory Ain to Frank Gehry that they influenced. As photographed by Julius Stuhlmann, the son of Russian Jewish immigrants, the California modern style, with its emphasis on fitting in with the environment and using glass walls to bring the outside in, spread around the world. And this is one of my favorite images. It's one of the first photographs that gives Los Angeles a very distinctive, recognizable look. And Julius Stuhlmann essentially invented architectural photography in Los Angeles. Another icon, Disney Hall. Conceived in 1987 and completed in 2003, Frank Gehry's Walt Disney Concert Hall served as a major component in the revitalization of downtown Los Angeles and gave the metropolis an instantly recognizable landmark, something that every major city needs. Architect Geary, born Goldberg, a Jewish Canadian transplant, took the California modernist principles and created an urban icon reflecting the optimism and energy of LA that he himself experienced. From the 1950s onward, with toys, Western wear, baseball, the Dodgers came to Los Angeles, and Roz Wyman, the Jewish city councilwoman, was very instrumental in making that happen. Television shows, Bonanza, the creation of a Jewish writer with two Jewish stars riding, you know, across the Western landscape. Pop art and monuments to music and theater. Jewish Angelenos made Los Angeles into a center of diverse American culture. With its tradition of Western individualism, metropolitan ambitions, and cutting-edge industries, LA continued to be an incubator for entrepreneurs and innovators. Now, one fun example of Jewish Angeleno innovation is Barbie. Probably the most famous American toy ever invented, Barbie was the brainchild of Ruth Handler, the daughter of Polish Jewish immigrants. Following a long tradition of Jewish women entrepreneurs working side by side with their husbands, Ruth and her husband Elliot founded Mattel in their garage in Los Angeles. In 1959, she gave the company its biggest seller. There's been more than 1 billion Barbies sold. And revolutionized the toy industry with the first mass-marketed adult-looking doll for girls. The popular baby dolls of the time encouraged girls to be mothers. Barbie encouraged girls to pursue all sorts of careers, from model to astronaut, and that was Ruth's intention. The Hawthorne, California-based Mattel became a global firm under Ruth's vision and leadership. Simultaneous to the maturation of Los Angeles as a metropolis with world-class architecture, cultural institutions, and innovating industries, Jewish Angelenos were planting the seeds of change for ways of being Jews, Americans, and global citizens. From the first efforts to create a Holocaust museum in the United States, which began in 1961, to the first gay and lesbian synagogue in the world, 1972, LA Jewry expanded the institutions of Jewish community, steadily increasing waves of immigrants from Israel, Iran, and the former Soviet Union, deepened the diversity of the Jewish population, and re-energized the community. At the same time, Jewish Angelenos were joining non-Jews in the civil rights, anti-war, and environmental movements sweeping the nation. One especially powerful example of the increasing influence of LA Jewry on the world is the etching shown here. Originally created for an art competition that limited the work to a 4-inch square, 2 inches by 2 inches, this image became the logo of the grassroots organization, Another Mother for Peace, and the most famous anti-war poster of the Vietnam War era. Artist Lorraine Art Snyder grew up in Boyle Heights, the daughter of Jewish immigrants. This was one of my most exciting discoveries, to find this connection to LA Jewish history. I feel particularly privileged to bring this to people's attention, because again, this is has to be one of the most famous protest posters ever created. Along with the liberal innovations in Jewish institutions, LA Jewry has embraced a particularly American urban approach to observing Jewish law. The Los Angeles Community Air Roof demonstrates that approach. It is the largest one in the world, 80 square miles, and bordered roughly by the 10, 101, and 405 freeways. It enables religiously observant Jews to experience fully the Sabbath. It requires a fully intact, continuous boundary created by walls, fences, and other permanent structures, and freeways make very useful boundaries in that way. With the work on the 405, disrupted the air roof for a little while, and they had to make some arrangements with some of that construction. Where such a permanent structure doesn't exist, flexible cable or wire is strung between existing light or telephone poles to create continuity. This whole structure was created by volunteers, and they had to map it out, get permissions, create this boundary, fill in where there weren't permanent structures. To ensure that it is intact, every week the entire boundary of the Eruv is checked by Orthodox rabbis from a helicopter. I would venture to say that is the only case in the world where the Eruv is checked by helicopter. LA County has several other Eruvim, making it home to half of the at least 12 Eruvim in California. So there's a large growing population in LA County of observant Jews to whom Eruvim are very important. And this is not showing as well as I'd hope, but of course, the Los Angeles Jewish community today extends beyond the Eruv. Jewish institutions, synagogues, day schools, community centers, social services, advocacy groups have spread across the county as Jewish Angelenos have followed the general residential patterns of other Angelenos, moving from the central plaza of the city in the 19th century, then west and south to the coast, and north and east to the county edges. The geography of Jewish organizations suggests a broad presence on the landscape that has become denser in some places, but has remained relatively widespread, which is a divergence from what has happened in other Jewish urban centers, where there's been generally a contraction and concentration in certain areas in metropolitan regions. But that density here in Los Angeles and that breadth represent the legacy of and the prospects for the ongoing relationship between Los Angeles and its Jews. Following in the footsteps of diaspora Jews from antiquity to the modern period, as described by Gershon Cohen, Jewish Angelenos have integrated not, quote, to make things easier, but as the result of a need to continue to make the Jewish tradition relevant. In the process, Jewish Angelenos, from the early settlers forward, have used the Cohen's term, the blessing of assimilation, to ensure that Jews and Judaism became and remain distinctly part of the ever-changing cultural mosaic called Los Angeles. On the 19th century California frontier, Jews could freely decide whether to remain Jews. They chose to be Jews and to adapt to their new home in ways that would enable other Jews to have the same option. Ever since, Jews have been exercising that option, continuing the mutually influential relationship that has remade Jewish and civic sensibilities, putting LA and its Jews in the vanguard of the emerging urban multicultural America that is, to steal a phrase from one of my mentors, hopefully heterogeneous. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.